Judge Ross, Chief Judge Siegel, and Judge Smith. The Honorable Kevin G. Ross presiding.
Good morning and welcome to the Court of Appeals for this November 4 panel and oral argument. The case before us is Leon Bond III, by and through Crystal Bond, his mother and natural guardian, versus the Independent School District 191 and others, respondents. Counsel, we are, of course, hosting the oral argument today by Zoom, online, an online platform. Occasionally, it may become glitchy. If it does, just please notify us somehow that you're having difficulty either hearing or seeing any of the judges or opposing counsel so that we can pause and try to catch up with let the technology catch up to us rather than continuing. We are producing only an audio recording of the proceedings, not a video recording. So although we can see you and see your names, the recording will not be able to do so. So please do state your name as you commence each leg of your argument for the sake of the recording. Each side will have 15 minutes to present your argument with an additional 5 minutes for the appellant's counsel, if you'd like to use that time for rebuttal. And with that, counsel for appellant, whenever you are ready to proceed, you have the floor.
Thank you, Your Honor. This is Vincent Moccio of Benarant & Associates for the plaintiff. May it please the court and counsel. We're here today to discuss an immunity issue. Very briefly, the case involves a hyperextension of an arm of a student at Burnsville High School by a teacher. Video of the incident was provided in discovery from a security camera. That has been made available to the Court of Appeals as it was to the court below. And I think all the parties agree that, for lack of a better way to put it, the best evidence of what happened is looking at that video. However, the video, and regardless of what it shows, begs the question of whether or not Mr. Meyer should be granted immunity, discretionary immunity, with regard to the actions that he took as shown on that video. And the question that's presented here is kind of a novel question, one that I don't think either party has been able to find any specific case law on, which is, if we assume and the appellants concede that Mr. Meyer had discretion with regard to whether or not to use force, then the issue becomes, does he have unfettered discretion to use any type of force in any manner that he sees fit and disregard the specific training that he was given on how to control a student so as to prevent injury? And in fact,
it seems like you're attempting to reframe a highly nuanced factual question into a legal question.
Well, to the extent that there's a factual question here, then that also would make the summary judgment improper, if I'm understanding your question, Your Honor. Beyond that, I think there is an important legal question, because as explained in our briefs, you basically elevate the teacher to a policymaking position and allow the teacher to do anything that he wants, regardless of the training that the school board certified and gave to the teachers. So I think it is an important legal question. And I don't think it's a question that the district court considered at all. The district court just looked at the handbook, said the teacher may use force, and therefore the teacher has discretion to use force in any way, shape, or form, even though we were given tens, if not hundreds, of slides used in the training that go into detail as to what position should be taken up, how the student should be restrained from behind, the fact that arms should be wrapped around and a basket hold should be used, that hyperextension of an arm or an extremity should never be done, all of the things that Mr. Meyer failed to do. He didn't.
So can I ask you a question though? Because we do have you know, established law. The problem is applying it to this set of facts, correct?
I think that's true, but yeah. The established law is on facts that are so different that I don't know how applicable it is without at least extending the law. And I'll be honest, I think what appellant is asking for here is a slight extension, although we think the Larson case is close when it says that whether or not to teach gymnastics is a discretionary policy level matter, but how you teach it becomes ministerial. And I think that's the closest we're going to get in the established case law.
So it seems like this case and the briefs analogize to, immunity for police officers or emergency personnel, you know, like there was in a, like there have been in other cases. So is that the right analogy? Because the district court did consider all of this, but it concluded that because it wasn't possible to do the, I'm going to call it the bear hug. I can't remember exactly what it's called.
Basket hug.
Thank you very much for that maneuver, because there wasn't room, that then it became a discretionary act. So what's your response to that? And how, and should we be looking at, the case law dealing with, ambulance drivers or police officers driving through intersections and using caution? I mean, is that the right standard? Because they are not managerial employees making, or superintendents making, policy level decisions, but those have been found, under common law official immunity, to be discretionary acts.
Well, several things there, Your Honor. I think you kind of hit at least three points.
I did ask multiple questions. My apologies on that.
Let me see. And I was trying to write them down here, but let's start with the last one first, which is the cases that are being analogized to by the respondent. And I think that I don't think you're going to find a case, at least I don't, the way I read the cases, I don't believe they address this point, where the distinction is as clear between the discretion that the actor has and then whether or not the actor gets to completely disregard training. And to bring it back to the police officer going through the intersection, in the last few years, there have been some new rules adopted. I'm not an expert on them, but from reading the newspaper, I know there have been some new rules adopted with regard to ceasing and desisting high-speed chases when they become dangerous to the public. And so you can easily, and you may face this question in the next few years, have a case that's very analogous to this one, where the officer disregards the new mandate, i.e. his training, and blows through an intersection at high speed and injures somebody. And then you're going to have the same question that we're presenting here, which is he had discretion in the initial decision to start the chase, but at what point does he get to disregard his training? And at what point does that training kick in and become a ministerial duty using, the case law that is often cited, and we cited as well, Anderson, merely the extension of a specific duty arising from fixed and designated facts, or the quotes, the mere existence of some degree of judgment or discretion will not necessarily confer common law official immunity. So you have those same questions. But to get back to your point, you can analogize to the past cases, but since I don't think they present this exact question, I think you are going to have to make a little bit of law here with regard to where that discretion ends and that ministerial act begins.
Let me pause you there. I mean, official immunity is not unique to Minnesota law. I think virtually every state has some form of it. Were you able to identify any case anywhere in the country where an official is given the discretion to use force, but then training, how that official may or may not have been trained, is incorporated as a limit on the use of force.
I did look, do a multi-state search, little bit of a difficult search to perform, and it's been a while, and I've looked several times. I have not found anything that was specifically on point. Now, whether or not that's because these cases just never made it to appellate courts, or they weren't presented in the exact framework that we're presenting it here, I don't know.
Well, it seems like, I mean, you know, a case that comes to mind more often than as parties have recognized, more often than teachers, in law enforcement. Law enforcement are consistently trained in the use of force. But, and so it seems to me that if your theory was plausible, you would find somewhere in the country, in perhaps many cases, where training is used to establish some type of a bright line restraint on the actual application of immunity. And I don't know that that exists. And if it does, correct me.
Well, I reject the notion that just because you couldn't find the case means that it shouldn't be the law. First of all, Your Honor, with all due respect. But second of all, I think, having done some police work myself over the years and a lot of jail work over the years, that situations where officials blatantly disregard their training tend to be cases that settle. And cases where there's a lot
cases where they disregard their training, or cases where the force is objectively unreasonable. Those are two different things.
They are two different things. And the case that we're talking about here today is a case where, first and foremost, we believe it's a case of disregarding training. And then perhaps there's a jury question, and I think there is a jury question as to whether or not then there's negligence. But we're here on an immunity defense. We're not necessarily here on summary judgment being granted on the question of, we're not here on summary judgment being granted on the question of whether or not there was negligence and there was objectively too much force being used.
But if I could, if your standard is correct, it seems to me that the doctrine of immunity, which is supposed to move cases aside, you know, to quickly resolve cases and not have to go through litigation, it seems to me that it creates a problem that every case would then have to be litigated in terms of training. You'd actually have to go through the trial, I suppose, or some significant fact-finding inquiry to answer the question of whether or not a particular technique was or was not within the training that was offered.
Again, Your Honor, I respectfully disagree, because here, had he tried to implement the training, tried to take the proper position, tried to use the bear hug, tried not to hyperextend the arm, then I think you can have a situation where someone can be injured, where the training is being implemented and the court can say he had discretion to use force. He used his training, things didn't go well, so he should be granted immunity. But our situation is not that.
It sounds like you're asking for a standard where a teacher is authorized to use, in the teacher's discretion, to use force to restrain a child or resolve a dispute, that the training itself limits the discretion. It seems like that's the rule that you're asking us to apply. Am I correct?
I don't believe we're, no, no. I don't agree with that as well.
It's a question.
And I'll answer the question in negative, which is that we're not saying that the training in any way, shape, or form affects his initial discretion to use force. He has the absolute discretion to use force. Once he decides to use it, if he's not going to reference or implement his training in any way, shape, or form, what is the point of the school board even mandating the training?
And since can you just provide for us, let's assume we agree with you And because you've acknowledged this would be uncharted territory in the country, in the state certainly, what is the holding? What is the rule of law that we would include as our syllabus point?
The rule of law is that there is discretion in the first place to use force, but that once force is implemented, the training, once force is applied, the training has to be implemented. And that just like Larson, where how you taught the gymnastics was ministerial, it would be ministerial to just apply the training.
What if there had been no training?
If there had been no training, then the school board would have been making a policy decision not to have training, and I would have no argument. But the school board did make a policy or a decision to use training, to have training and to disperse that training and have seminars and bring people into classes for hours at a time to listen to this training and produce all of these slides. And basically what the defendants are saying is we can disregard all of that and disregard the policy level decision to implement that training and give unfettered discretion. I totally agree. If there had been no training, I'd have no case. But there was training, and it's our argument that it's ministerial to implement that training and that discretion should not be granted.
Judge Ross, can I ask a question?
Yes, please do.
So is it your position that the training, what was said in the training, is equivalent to a policy or protocol? I mean, sort of, you know, like the Anderson, the Anoka school district case.
Yes, that is our position.
And if that's so, don't you have to show that that was communicated as that it was the training was presented in that fashion, that the training is a limit on discretion, not just a here's one way you might be able to apply force?
Well, I don't know that it would have to. If you're asking, do they have to stand up at the beginning of the class and say, this is a limit on discretion? I don't believe so. I don't know that's a proper.
Communicate in some way that this is not just a, here's how you can use force, but here's how you must use force in all circumstances.
Or must not use force because it includes prohibited practices. That's now the not just a training put on by this trainer, but that is the policy or protocol of the school.
I think this actually gets to the last point that I was going to make had I just made my argument, which of course you never get to do, but that's fine. It's more fun this way anyway. And that last point is. There are issues of fact then that arise as to whether or not he could have used the training in this situation. And basically, I think what the issue becomes is, okay, we give you training. There's probably going to arise times when it's not going to be useful, when situations are going to happen where you can't strictly use it. And Mr. Meyer's testimony was, I couldn't use the basket hold. And I think if you look at that videotape, even though that statement was accepted as true by the trial court, there is clearly a question of fact there as to whether or not he could have used the basket hold. He's standing behind them, and rather than do it, he pulls the arm.
All right, I think you've answered the question sufficiently that we'll have to end your argument because of the running of time, but you have 5 minutes of additional time for rebuttal, and you can certainly follow up on any points you'd like to re-raise. Counsel for respondent.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Sally Ferguson, and I represent respondents Joseph Meyer and Independent School District Number 191. I want to make it clear here that what we're talking about is a situation where an educator is faced with an unforeseeable and unpredictable behavior situation. He's attempting to protect a student. And in this case, he used his professional judgment to determine that under the facts of this case, reasonable force, not just force, but reasonable force was appropriate to protect student P. Minnesota law allows that, and the district policy also allows it. It's not that he has unfettered discretion. In fact, his conduct was reviewed by the Minnesota Department of Education, and it was concluded that reasonable force was appropriate. I agree with Appellant on one point, and that is the video is the best evidence in this case because it demonstrates nothing other than reasonable force. Appellant has produced.
Aren't you getting into fact issues then? I mean, well, the judge then is sitting as a fact finder on a summary judgment motion.
I think the video was presented just to oversee what happened on that particular day, because there's been reference throughout the argument that this was force and he had unfettered discretion, and there's certainly no evidence of that. An appellant has presented no evidence that the force used was unreasonable, no evidence that the student that Mr. Meyer was concerned about wasn't in imminent force or imminent fear of harm. No evidence to dispute that Mr. Meyer acted reasonably in this situation. So we ask this court to affirm the district court's decision.
If the standard were just whether it was reasonable force, you're perhaps right. But I think the argument that's being asserted is that reasonableness is not the restraint. It's not the only restraint. You have an additional restraint, which is the training. The training imposes a ministerial limit on what force is allowed within the teacher's discretion. I believe that's I'm sure I'll get corrected if I'm wrong about that in a few minutes. But if I'm correct, I don't know that your reasonableness argument actually addresses the position by the appellant.
Let me get to the issue of discretionary use. And the training, the MANT training, is not a limit on the type of force or the discretion that can be used. Again, the situation here is the split second decision. It's very unlike the cases cited by plaintiff or appellant, the Anderson case or the Larson case involving the teaching of how to do a head spring, something that an everyday teacher should follow their training in the physical education class, or the use of a...
But isn't this a lot like the head spring in a way? I mean,
not
the,
at all. I mean, because...
I haven't got a question. So the MANT training, there's a big slide. There's several of them that say prohibited practices. I mean, prohibited practices, which one would think, oh, that sounds like something I'm never supposed to do. And my school is telling me I'm never supposed to do this. And one of those is potential risk of hyperextension. And so why is Mr. Mochio wrong that all of a sudden this is a ministerial versus a discretionary act in terms of what's allowed once you make the discretionary decision that you need to use force?
So it's not ministerial because you have to make a split second judgment call, as opposed to in the cases he cites, which involves just I'll follow the gymnastics or the Phi Ed handbook on how to teach a head spring. He has to look at the situation he's involved in and decide, how do I react? If it were a perfect world and there was time to determine I need to restrain this individual, then you can use the basket hold. Here he has to determine, I need to protect student P from harm, and what's the appropriate way to do that?
So what is there any case law talking about that split second decision making is the difference between discretionary and a ministerial act?
I think the cases that we cited, the Sletten case, the Elwood case, they talk about public officials that are charged with duties which call for the exercise of judgment. And I think those are the cases most analogous here, because that's what he was doing. He's got a student that is potentially going to be hurt, And he's making a judgment call, as he's allowed to do under the common law immunity.
Excuse me. What the appellant seems to be asking for is a strict, almost a strict liability if you violate the training. Why should we not apply that standard that if there is training that it becomes ministerial as a matter of per se facto?
Well, there's no evidence in this case that this training limits his discretion. And if you were to determine this is a strict liability situation, you would be tying the hands of educators in making any decision based with, in this case, behavioral situation, which is going to escalate into a fight. So if he were to be required to follow his training and do a basket hold where he couldn't have time to do that, he's got to have the ability to make that decision, that discretion.
Okay, thank you for answering the question.
I think, as I've already indicated, we dispute the Larson and Anderson cases as being at all similar. They are very ministerial. Anderson involving a teacher allowing the use of a push stick when a student is using a circular saw, that would be totally contrary to the training of a teacher in shop, or the teaching of a head spring, which the students weren't at the level to even learn, as in the Larson case, not applicable at all. What appellant has done here is simply second guessing Mr. Meyer's use of reasonable force and repeats arguments that the court has already rejected. And for those reasons, we ask this court to affirm the district court's decision.
Thank you, Ms. Ferguson. Any rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. And I'd like to start with the strict liability point. We are not asking for strict liability.
Quick reminder for the audio recording. Go ahead. We know who you are. We can
see. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Well, you did introduce me by saying Mr. Mochio. So I am Mr. Mochio. And I'd like to start with the strict liability point, which is it's important to keep in mind that even though we're here on a summary judgment grant, we're here on a summary judgment grant in the context of discretionary immunity, not in the context of there being no evidence whatsoever. The strict liability point is really a point that goes to liability, as the phrase contains. We're not saying that any time there's a violation of training, that therefore the teacher or the official is strictly liable and you just get to damages. We're not saying that at all. What we're saying is that in order to get discretionary immunity, you have to have a discretionary act. And that violating the training is ministerial. That once he gets to the training part, because he's made the discretionary decision to use force, now he's ministerially providing his or applying his training. And if he wants to make a defense that he couldn't use the training in this particular instance, that's not a immunity defense. That's a defense that he then puts in front of the jury, and they may find, yes, he used reasonable force because he couldn't use his training, or he used his training and someone got hurt, so he used reasonable force. There seems to be a lot of confusion today, if I may, between the liability part and the discretionary immunity part.
Is there anything in the record that would indicate that the training was intended to be the exclusive means of applying one's discretion in using force to resolve a physical altercation with a student?
Well, I think Judge Siegel came as close as you're going to get to that when she says that several of the slides say this is prohibited activity. And if it's prohibited activity, then it's something you're not supposed to be doing. In other words, The school board has looked at the way students can be restrained and has decided there are ways to do it that will minimize risk of injury. And one of the things that you're supposed to do to minimize the risk of injury is use something like the basket hold, rather than grabbing an arm and pulling it out of the socket. Now,
so Mr. Mocho, so is there anything in the record about what the teachers were told at the start of the training or the purpose of the training? I mean, something that might say, this is more than what the MANT system folks are telling you. This is school policy.
Well, having not had the opportunity, even through normal discovery means, to attend the training, certainly not the training that Mr. Meyer got, I can't answer that question with certainty. All I have through this discovery is the slides and then Mr. Meyer's testimony and the testimony of some other school officials as to the scope of the training, which, without putting too fine a point on it, is somewhat self-serving, as you would expect. I'm not saying they lied, but they certainly framed things in a way that was favorable to their case. So no, having not been at the training and having no verbatim transcript or video of the training, I cannot answer that question. But I'm not sure it's important, and here's why. If once you start getting into how you're going to restrain, you're into a ministerial act, then I don't think it matters whether or not you announce to officers, teachers, ambulance drivers, here's where the line is. What you're telling them is you have to use your judgment as to whether or not to use force. And when you use your judgment, here's the way we want you to do it. And as I've said several times, and I hate to be redundant, there are ways out of that that they can argue to the jury. But the whole question here, my time's running out, the whole question here is, are we going to get to a jury or not? Are we going to have the jury consideration taken away from us because he gets discretionary immunity when he completely disregarded his training? I just want the opportunity to present those questions to a jury, and I may very well lose, but I would like the opportunity to present them, because I don't think giving carte blanche to teachers to totally disregard the training makes any sense where the school board has authorized and paid for expensive training. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you to both counsel. Very interesting case. As both of you seem to acknowledge, it seems to be one of first impression. Thank you for your briefing, your oral argument. We will issue our opinion within the statutory period. The matter is submitted.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you both, and have a wonderful day.
You too. You too.
The court is